This feature has been brought to you by Slot Foundation, which needs your support to continue projects like these. Information on this recording and access to other recordings is available online at slot.org. My name is Aaron Levy. We're here today in Philadelphia with Bratzo Dmitrievic, who's here at the Slot Foundation Galleries for a retrospective exhibition, The Ways to Post-History, as well as an outdoor facade project, The Casual Passerby I Met at 3:01 p.m., Philadelphia, April 2007. Bratzo is here today with the RBSL Bergman Foundation Seminar from the University of Pennsylvania, and the students in the seminar are spending their year working on a series of curatorial projects, including Bratzo's. In particular, we're interested today in the notion of documentation, and so many of the questions that we'll each pose will address this particular body of work that we're exhibiting from that perspective. With that, I just ask that everybody actually go around and speak their name into the microphone.
Nicole Garman.
Alicia Polinisi.
Peter Richman.
Laura Fox.
Bratzo Dmitrievic.
Christine Weller.
Nena Dmitrievic.
Wendy Tai.
Becca Starr.
David Jagannath.
The kind of urbanistic background of my work is really probably not the appropriate description. So what I always related to was the history, because I treated the history almost as a physical environment, although the history is a kind of something that is metaphysical, or it's a science, it's not of the material nature. And I always consider that history is the environment that I wanted to kind of change, starting from the premise that history is reduced vision of the past, that past is something a lot more complex. And I also had this sentence in my first years of studying in 1968, when I shaped it into the statement, there are no mistakes in history, the whole of history is a mistake. So having in mind that every environment, physical, social, psychological, is shaping our behavior, I wanted to do something which would be kind of like a utopian need to change this, what was wrong to my mind for centuries. And through my artistic practice, obviously I had to relate to environment, and kind of urban settings were already shaped by the historic ones. And then I started reappropriating this vocabulary of urban mobiliarium, that is the monuments, the kind of billboards, memorial plaques on the facade, who lived there, who didn't live there, and so on. And well, as I said, the only utopias that I really like are the artistic ones, and utopia is good until it deals with human lives. So there were other kinds of utopia which kind of dealt with human lives, and artistic ones are having no consequences to human life. And this was just an indication that one with its own individual means could kind of indicate that one could create a kind of parallel history in order to point that the official history was sometimes wrong, or sometimes the incomplete image of the past. So just to give an example, in my book Tractatus Post Historicus, which was let's say, published 6 years before Charles Jenks used the term the postmodernism in the field of architecture. Later the term expanded also to different fields, including the visual arts. And that book, which was public in City of Tübingen in Germany, and by coincidence, the great German philosophers like Bloch and Herbert Marcuse, and I mean, Tübingen had a long tradition and long links with philosophers. By coincidence, this book was published there, and it has different chapters, and in one of the chapters, I talk about, for instance, monuments and memorial plaques, that they are no innocent signs of indicating that somebody either lived in certain city or house, or and then I made kind of analysis that implicit message of every memorial plaque, if you find a, for instance, Handel's house or Mozart's house saying Mozart lived here, the explicit message of every house with no plaque is that, the implicit message of Mozart's plaque is saying like the genius lived here, and the house with no plaque is saying genius never lived here. And just to give you some examples that you are familiar with, like El Greco, who is one of the greatest painters of mid-16th century. He was kind of not known to public until the late 19th century. And he was kind of rediscovered, although in most of the churches in Toledo, where he finally settled after not having any success in Dubrovnik, in Venice, in Milan, and at the French court, he reached Spain, and he became kind of like number two painter, because he was not a court painter, but then the church provided some bread for him, and so in Toledo, in many altar places, you had these wonderful El Greco paintings, and they were simply not seen, or they were forgotten, despite the fact that people were praying in front of them every day. Another example in the recent history is Kazimir Malevich. In 1953, I remember this book when my father brought it from Paris. He got it the same year it was published by Skira Editions, and it is a book on abstract art, and there is no mention of Malevich, there is not one photo of Malevich, there is no one reproduction of Malevich's Black Square, which is the first and the most radical example of geometric abstraction in modern world, meaning past 5,000 years. So then you start to think, really, how is this possible? I mean, what are the kind of like visible and invisible reasons for this? And as an individual, I was aware quite early and about these omissions, and then I simply came to this conclusion that past cannot be represented with the kind of single truth, and that the past is something a lot more multi-layered, and that actually something as a history or science of history is just mutilated image of the past. So that answers the need to intervene in public context and to insert this monument, to kind of make these large photographs of the casual passers-by, and the idea to mimic the history just to prove that one can create any kind of history according to one's own needs.
So as you pose your questions to Brazzo, can you just speak into the mic, and also for the first time you ask your question, just state your name?
My name's Laura, and I have a question that follows up. You mentioned this utopic view of art, and actually in reference to El Greco, Nena, or you have been quoted as saying that there was a lack of tolerance that prevents us from seeing certain things, and that the utopic view is that that there's this more liberated, individual-based appeal to art that can evolve. And do you see this in people's view of art, or do you see this trend as having a more significant impact socio-politically outside of the art world? This new.
It is general. It applies to all fields of human activity. But since I am an artist, I prefer to talk about examples that are kind of related to art. But in the Tractatus book, there is a chapter which is entitled "The Style is a Reflection of Racism in Art." In other words, I'm strongly convinced that in time of Rococo, when everybody was painting flowers, that there was at least one individual who said, "I'll make a black square." But he was excluded because there was no place, because the human brain is not equipped to deal with variety of things at one given moment. So I would say it applies to all fields of kind of human perception, but closest to me is the field of art, and I think that this chapter with this title explains the wider meaning of it.
My name is Peter, and I have a question that touches on your dual role as an artist and a theorist. Really, if such a distinction is even possible or relevant. So as a conceptual artist, your work is heavily grounded in concept, in post-history. So what motivated you to write your book? Was it a need to expound further on things that couldn't be explored solely through art, a fear of being misunderstood? Well, why did you feel that you needed to add something more to the artwork?
First of all, a real artist has no fear of anything. not even being cursed in the train. So looking back also at a certain kind of heroes of mine, which include Malevich, Kafka, Tesla, I mean people really from different fields, is that I mean, if you can paint, I think you can compose, and if you can compose, you can also write. And when I was mentioning utopia or artists who were into kind of utopian thinking, these were for me the great visionaries, because I would divide the kind of artists into kind of two categories. There are people who are creative, but they are kind of like more manual and less conceptual. Kind of, they are very good painters, but probably they don't have the whole philosophy behind them, and even less the capacity to write about their paintings. But I think all these people that I mentioned, and there are many more, They have clear vision of what they want to do, so they express themselves through different medias. And I mean, as far as my personal practice is concerned, I started using like photography to begin with, and the video and films, and then just a year after, I started using a kind of like marble and bronze, just to disassociate myself from any formalism, and the nature of my work also needed all these different means in order to transfer the message I was trying to convey to the larger audience.
Can you speak to the way that gesture was received initially at a time when curators weren't necessarily inviting you to do what you do now?
Well, I went through different stages. Like one very concrete example was that in Harald Zeman's documenta in the Museum Friedrichianum in Kassel, and that was in 72, just one day before the opening, I remember my works were installed in the same space. Like we had the wall each, Rebecca Horn, Yoko Ono, and myself, and then there was an opening, so there was no fourth wall. And the aluminium framing was a very common thing in those days, and it's still now, and it's coming back. So I remember two ladies were coming into this space, and they were saying, hurry up, there are more aluminium frames. Like she meant there are more avant-garde works in the show. And then I was kind of completely shocked by this kind of formalistic approach, that she would identify anything that was aluminium framed would be automatically belonging to the field of conceptual art. And as a reaction to that, when I reached my house, I painted a series of Jackson Pollock paintings, and I wrote a text which had, I think, some influence in the 80s, a lot of influence in the 80s, where I'm kind of advocating the new art movement, which would be based on unoriginality. And there was this text which says, why do I paint like Pollock? And obviously, I mean, for many people it was kind of shocking to see that somebody who had his own kind of oeuvre already kind of very elaborated to these large photographs, monuments, memorial plaques, etc., started doing something that was totally unoriginal. And then artists are rarely kind of interested into the very obvious things, but they like to relate to the very obvious things. And then I remember when I wrote this essay, and one of the points of these paintings, when they were shown at the Sperone Gallery, who was showing people who were close to Pollock generation-wise, like Jasper Johns and so on, Rauschenberg and Andy Warhol, for example, they would come to the same automatical conclusion that it was the original Jackson Pollock. Like, in all my works, there is a kind of like, or in most of my works, especially in certain cycles, I like to kind of mislead a spectator. So if they're confronted with a big photograph, they would say, depending on the country or depending on the election period, is that kind of like politician or media star? And then when they receive this information that this is somebody chosen by chance, then if this process is repeated, then they would next time, when seeing a passerby or when seeing somebody officially kind of according to historical or very conventional criteria selected for this kind of presentation, they would think, knowing my work, that it's probably a passerby. So to be back to this Pollock paintings, I asked 1,000 more than the original Pollock paintings. And in 72, there was an auction, and Jackson Pollock was the first artist who exceeded, who went over the top of $1 million. And I was asking for my Pollocks $1,001,000. Obviously, I never sold any. But this was not the point. And the people would ask, why is this, okay, if it's so well painted like Pollock, you should not be asking 1,000 more. You should ask the same price. I mean, there were like these theoretical or everyday arguments. And I said, okay, let's say there is something wrong in your kitchen with the taps, and then there is a kind of dripping, and then like washer is gone, and there is a plumber that comes and he replaces it quickly, and then he was paid like $80, he's gone, and you said, I could have done it myself. That's where I relate to the obvious in the terms that what you really paid was plumber's experience. So, as I used to say, I do all kinds of installations, so I mean, it's not strange to me to relate to the plumbing or central heating or whatever installation is in question. But since I knew more about the Pollock for the simple fact that he died in 56, my art experience was much wider than his. So I knew about the pop art, which came after him, and then I knew about the minimal art, and then I was one of the people who was kind of who created the conceptual art. So then I said I could charge $1,000 more than Pollock for the same job. So, well, this is the could you just add something to your question?
I could try.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what stands out to me about what you just said is that you see yourself as primarily working with theory, and then whether it's writing or painting or photography, those all seem to be products of the theory. So I guess my original...
No, it's a product of the certain kind of philosophy.
Right.
And I sometimes would say that I would see myself as a kind of theorist or philosopher, but since being in the visual arts, so using the kind of visual language, you communicate with the speed of light. And since I'm very impatient, I think it's faster to kind of transfer a message through an exhibition than through the book reading or showing a film. This is lasting 2 hours. So I think with some people, these things are kind of inseparable. I mean, they have all this in themselves, so I mean, they can possibly write as well as they paint or compose the music. So,
well, that answers my question.
Mm-hmm. Thanks.
I have actually a bunch of questions. I actually have one for Nana. And we've seen you come here, and I've seen you hold the camera and, you know, following around, kind of getting the documentation. We've also read stuff you've written about Brazzo. And I was just wondering how you see your role in kind of the grand scheme of things as art historian and documenter and, you know, and wife, and just kind of what your experience has been.
Is it just in case if you meet an artist you like, just to know whether to go out with him or eventually to marry him, or then don't listen to me.
Well, maybe following Brat's practice, and being
closer,
part
Nina, to
of
mic.
Conceptual art critics, I maybe shaped also some of my discourses inspired by his practice. And one digression I just wanted to point, that the context where he was creating these works was, I would like to remind of the context, I mean, and you might not be aware of it being so much younger, that in the early days or early years of conceptual art, the idea was that an artist can use any media at hand, meaning if he's got to express certain idea, he can use languages, art and language did, he can use mainly photography as new media in art, because before it was just photography as photography, but photography as art was really introduced by the generation of conceptual artists. But very soon, this apparent freedom of expression, of freedom of use of different media, became a new dogma, meaning that conceptual art or avant-garde, which was very kind of heroic term of those years, became identified with just photography and text. So whoever would claim freedom to express himself through just painting would be seen as very retrograde, reactionary. So I think one of the innovations Bratzo brought into the field was to really use this freedom by expressing his idea, his artistic philosophy, through very classical media. And the whole humor and irony of it was that he claimed the most traditional media, like bronze, which is like 1,000 years old art material, or marble. And but at the same time, he didn't give up on photography and text. So this freedom, in a way, I think anticipated postmodernist attitude. And in his case, it came out of the just need to mimicry the language of historic glorification of personalities or modern glorification. So he would intervene in the language and the semiotic of the city. He would use the contemporary media as photography on billboards, posters was also were also one of the possibilities. But also, you know, memorial plaques and monuments, obviously. And the whole idea of just mimicking language or appropriating the language of the historical contemporary glorification of personalities or ideas led him to this variety of techniques and media. And I think later in the 80s it became like almost a fashion in a way, or with postmodernist attitude it claimed as possibility for many artists.
Does it answer your question? Or?
Yes, sure. And I mean, also, I'm just kind of curious how you, how you personally feel when you're, you know, when you're working with him, or, you know, as the holding the camera as the passerby is unfurled, and just kind of how you balance art historian and, you know, your personal relationship with the artist.
Well, as I said, we collaborate on some texts and things. But I think also one advantage as a critic, which I draw from liaison with Brazzo, is being present in many artist studios at the very early stage, you know, like Boyce's very close friend. So I don't know how many young critics have opportunity to be in the studios of the artist when they are just creating work. So when they're, you know, because Bratz was part of that scene, so he would be having access, and he was a friend with this artist. So me as a critic has had advantage of interviewing them or seeing the works at the very early stage or really being part of all that, that maybe is just a critic I wouldn't be able to.
Alicia?
Hi, I'm Alicia. Actually, I have a question that's kind of touching on what Becca was asking about, just about the role of documentation in this work and how important that is in relative to the actual work itself, and kind of how much documentation you see is necessary for certain pieces, and also like how you see your own involvement in the pieces, like in The Passersby, you're absent, but there's this obvious statement that, you know, as the artist, you've chosen this person, and then you have these other photographs where you're in the pictures, kind of in this, like, snapshot with, you know, various celebrities. So just if you could talk about, you know, like, your level of involvement and documenting these things.
I must say that all photographs are of equal importance to me. And somehow... of equal importance to me. If I'm with Joseph Beuys or Queen Sofia of Spain, it's to me like being with the casual passers-by. And I used to say that sometimes casual passer-by is my alter ego and the replacement for my ignorance, because he knows everything I don't know. And for me, passerby is also a kind of metaphor for a new concepts and different knowledge. And I grew up in the circumstances where my father would know many kind of well-known artists or writers, some Nobel Prize winners like Ivo Andrić or Jean-Paul Sartre. But then, I don't know, is it this kind of upbringing in the milieu which had, or my parents had the respect also for the neighbors who were not Nobel Prize winners or for the people who would deliver the groceries. I don't know, is it related to that, or is it related to something else that was kind of inborn? But somehow I have always had my own kind of priorities and my kind of hierarchies. So I never would take for granted somebody who was prized by the newspapers just because he was in the newspapers. And somehow I always had some distance to authoritarian thinking in general. So I think the documentation referring to kind of private life and kind of like artistic life is somehow acting like two mirrors, because you may see in the kind of private life, if you see photographs of me with somebody who is from the public life, it implies that probably I'm doing the passerbys because I was simply in the possibility of probably meeting somebody who belonged to history. I mean, it works both ways. So
but maybe I would say about the role of documentation in the work, I think it's essential because the work happens in the public context, speaking now about casual passers-by. And as Bratzo mentioned, deception is a part of it. The part of the idea of his concept is that you are deceived by it. I mean, that you're puzzled, you don't know the answer, who is actually the person. And then, you know, when coming to a gallery or just any place, public indoor space, museum or whatever, you find out who the person was. So it's complementary to the, it makes part of the work. Because only when you learn that it's a passerby, you started asking questions about the fame, the history, the context, the mechanism, which really select some people for to be historically promoted, and that's the others omitted from it, and so on.
So from the start, I mean, like work goes it happens in two acts or in two stages. Like one is that you are misled because simply you grew up most of your life with this kind of huge photographs with monuments and public squares, memorial plaques, and then I kind of installed this work in the urban context, and obviously seeing that very same kind of presentation, you would conclude that this person whose name is on a memorial plaque that lived there from 68 to 72 is equally important like Charles Darwin. And then when you come to the gallery, that's the second act or second kind of stage, you read that this is a passerby, and somehow you see that you were wrong, that you were kind of, that your mind was already shaped by the existing forms which existed for millenniums. And if you refer to that kind of documentation, it's quite essential for the work to exist, because there were situations where, for instance, I became aware for the first time when I exhibited, there was a conceptual section of the Paris Biennale in 71, and there was one photograph installed far away from the exhibition on Boulevard Saint-Germain, and there were statistics that about 5 million people drive through Boulevard Saint-Germain because it is a very important transportation acts from west to east. So whoever wants to cross the city goes to there, and then suddenly there was this passerby which was seen by 5 million people a day. But then there are maybe half of those people who don't see it because it's kind of like very mimicric to the rest of the large posters. And then half of the half, like one quarter, probably think who would that be, and then maybe there are 5% of this quarter who would ever learn that this is an artwork, and then 5% of this 5% who would really get what it is about. But I'm opting, I mean, as far, I mean, I made some earlier works which were referring to this question of perception. And I think a great percentage of my work, I mean, deals with this key issue of physical and the kind of mental perception of things, is it enough if you have a proposition and that the position is correctly perceived by the recipient? And I think that's how the world and the ideas really developed, because, I might be writing soon, and I wrote already about this, and the possible title of this piece would be Aerodynamics of Stupidity. The more idea is stupid, it penetrates faster into society, and then if you have something very complex, obviously, I mean, there are less and less, I mean, not less and less, there are less people who would be able to understand instantly what is it about. And I think there are good and bad times of kind of civilization, and when the kind of prevailing percentage is like kind of able to understand some propositions, and I think this is when the kind of new art movements or new inventions are accepted. Like suddenly you have, like we were lucky, I'm sure you will have this very soon, but there are these voids in history where nothing happens, and it's not that nothing happens because there are no creative people around. Nothing happens because there are no kind of artists, there are no kind of theoreticians, there are no kind of curators, there are no galleries, there are no collectors, and no kind of museums to house or to elaborate these ideas. Like you exist somewhere in the vacuum, and I always believe that there is a Kafka which works somewhere in Alaska in the post office, but unfortunately there is no structure to elaborate his thoughts. And actually what happened to Kafka for the kind of his for the betrayal of his friend, we are lucky to have Kafka's work today, because Kafka didn't have enough strength to burn his own manuscript, and he asked Max Brod to burn it all, and Max Brod promised that he would burn, and luckily he didn't.
So what would the ideal museum look like to house all of these creative gestures, which are not necessarily always making their way into storehouses of knowledge? Yesterday we had this discussion, which was related to what the class has been reading about, which is the genealogy of the white box, the white cube, museological space. What would be an ideal setting for you, in a way? What would be the ideal museological structure, not just for your work, which is so oriented to the modernist conception of the white box, but also, you know, with an eye towards all these other practices which in theory could make their way in?
I can't answer to this question. I can just use the... I just know what museum shouldn't be.
What would that be?
I mean, like, I think it's meaningless to have the museum in New York, which looks exactly the same like a museum in London or Paris or Düsseldorf or Beijing or in Seoul.
You mean both architecturally but also curatorially? You
mean, yeah.
In every sense?
Yeah, so I think... if we start elaborating on this, then we might come to the conclusion what the museum should look like. Mm-hmm. And before we used to have, I mean, we just caught the last probably minutes of it. And I recall, and I always like to talk about a perfect example of a curator who was already at a certain age when I met him, and I'm referring to Johannes Kladers, who co-curated Documenta 5 with Harald Zeman. And he was working in a small city of Krefeld, in that museum, which was the museum for a certain generation, because they started showing Yves Klein, Otto Pine, and a great number of the good artists of the time, a Zero group. And then when the director retired in that museum in Krefeld, he offered the job to Johannes Kladers, and then he said, I think we should leave it as it is. You better find somebody else. And he moved to kind of virgin situation, to another small industrial city of Mönchengladbach. And before I visited it, I thought it was as big as New York, I mean. And it's a small city with maybe only 100,000 people. But what was interesting about the institution he ran, the museum in Mönchengladbach, was that he started giving solo shows to the living artist, which was not the practice before him. Like, he started, I can't remember exactly, did he open the museum with a show of boys, and then second show was Jasper Johns, and then he reached people who were like 30 years younger than Jasper Johns, and he gave me the first museum show in Germany, and then he gave the first museum show to Kunelis, to great artists who were painters like Gerd Richter, and other artists like Marcel Brotters or Panamarenko or Gilbert and George. So great variety of things, and now it's a very common practice to have a solo show of the living artist, but when he started, it was totally unusual. And so that was one of the good examples how museum, of one model, how museum could function just by having a very strong, independent individual who is so well informed and kind of looking to find different examples and different languages of expression.
But you don't need to curate a Joseph Beuys, and you don't need to curate Bratzo Dmitrievich, because your work is already curated in a way by you. So in a way, that sensibility that you respected him for was on the level of the invitation. Right.
But then it redefines the position of the curator, because suddenly curating became writing a nice letter to the good address. You know, like painting changed the forms, so the curating also changed the form, because the man decided just to write a letter and said, okay, I'm offering you 3 floors of this building. And he had another fantastic attitude, and that is that he would ask an artist, no, he would, after the opening, there was a meeting set with an artist just before he would leave, and he would say, I'm buying like these 3 works, but there is the money for the 4th one. What do you suggest? And then artist would suggest the piece which was probably omitted by the curator, which artist would kind of consider as terribly important to him. And through this kind of idea of him asking artist suggestion, we accomplished something which I think was extremely important to me, and I think it became important in general, is that I asked him to buy a piece of art which was in the museum collection for 50 years. And I just renamed that artwork, and I asked that the work is half-time exhibited under my name and with this other title. So there was no transfer of object, there was just transfer of money.
And
I mean...
And meaning.
And meaning, of course. Yeah. No, I mean, in those years, the idea of, I think, the materialization of art as perceived by Lucy Lippard, who is a great American critic, and she published the book under that title as well. But we always had, since we were kind of good friends and we would meet for dinners and discussions, I would always point that probably if there was like an artist like Robert Barry who would fill one room with the neon gas or propane gas in the next room, that this would be still a new material. It is invisible, but it is a new material. And I was always interested in this other shift of meaning, like what this can mean at this very moment. Okay, it's a microphone, but maybe it could be an arm, or maybe it could be a kind of sexual instrument, or God knows what. But I also published a book of stories which are related to some real facts. And there is a story which is based on a very small article in the Times that appeared in late 70s. And in the Times, a very short article in the Times, had the title, Four Bottles of Vodka Exchanged for Dresden Tintoretto. And the real story happens in Dresden, when the Nazi Germany cities were bombed by the Allies. And then in this mess, the true story is that there is a guy who, a Russian soldier, who sees another soldier running away from Dresden Museum, which was one of the richest in terms of collection in all of Germany and maybe in Europe, that he is running away from this museum, which is inflamed with this Tintoretto painting, and then he offers him four bottles of vodka, and the other guy accepts the four bottles of vodka and gives him this painting. And then this painting disappeared for, I think, 40 years, almost. And then, if you read this, okay, you get the horror of this kind of, like, museum building burning with all these masterpieces. Then you get into the reasoning, okay, it's burning because the Nazis committed these atrocities, and then you focus on these two kind of characters, and then you think, like, that one guy was totally uninformed, and that the other guy was kind of like cunning, or
maybe your point is that, you know, the value of something is quite relative, and
of course I'm coming to this, yeah. And anyway, so suddenly you realize there is a situation where the four bottles of vodka were equivalent to master painting, which is worth like 100 million. Yeah, priceless. And then in my story there is a little twist, and that is that the person who seemed to be cheated profoundly disliked Tintoretto all his life and preferred to get drunk. So, because he was a great fan of Titian. And then he gives to this other guy who thinks that he has got a big deal, and he gives him with pleasure this Tintoretto, and then gets drunk around the corner in the basement of the building, which was not burning. So, anyway, this is just one of example how kind of things can be quickly redefined.
So who else has a question? Do you, Nicole, have a question?
My name is David Jagannath, and Nana was talking about the importance of documentation, and we talked about kind of the relationship with curatorial practice. But my question would be, is there such thing as too much documentation to the extent that you kind of lose that ambiguity between the five and the 5 million, and or to the extent that you kind of then join the historical practice that in a sense you're kind of going against? Are you putting so much documentation that you're creating meaning, where it could be kind of site-specific and dependent on the person that's looking at the piece?
I think I have a work here which is a good example of the documentation is, that there is never too much documentation. Like, I'm seeing this piece after 32 years, and I still don't know whether the messages would come through from this piece, because there is quite a lot in it. Obviously the first row of photographs is referring to passerby pieces where you have a memorial plaque, But many people, even if they read the casual passer, John Foster, the casual passerby, they would not think probably that John Foster was the casual passerby. And then, like when I'm standing on the New York street in 75 with two passersby, it is a reference to the group photographs. And for instance, I'm sure you came in your practice across many books where you would see the group photograph like Max Ernst, Marcel Duchamp, Unknown, and then Francis Picabia. And you would always ask yourself, was this guy kind of like more intelligent or total idiot to be in the company? Or why is he forgotten, omitted? Why there is no his name? And obviously, if he was drinking or coming out of the restaurant with his three geniuses, why suddenly there is no his name? And so I think there is never enough documentation. But the problem with documentation is that I think we should store material of kind of different sources or different fields or different, I mean, as diverse as possible in order not to damage the complexity of the past.
But so how would you classify all this new documentation that, in theory, you would recommend be compiled? For instance, when you do a project on Malevich, should it be filed under Brazzo or under Kazimir?
Both.
And potentially
yeah, like
other
for instance,
classification
yeah,
systems.
Like I can give you an example. I did this show in the Museum of Darmstadt. And the Darmstadt is the first museum that opened to public. It's a city which is just like 20 miles away from Frankfurt in the center of Germany. And it is the Duke of Hessen who is who collected and who formed, I mean, the Dukes of Hessen. Through generations, they collected the things and then they formed this cabinet of curiosity. And they had like lizards next to the Holbeins and then Holbeins next to the precious stones and minerals and things like that. And then they are also known for the second half of the 20th century just because there was a German banker who bought 100 works of Joseph Beuys and donated it to that museum. And like if we go through kind of retrospectively through the history of the main kind, you would see that probably at the very end of the cave there were kind of useful things. Right in the front of the cave there were all these bones. And then among the useful things you would see the variety of objects. And that principle stayed kind of present throughout maybe the end of 17th century and early 18th century. And then when the kind of modern museums, I mean in the forms as we know the museums nowadays, appear on the horizon, they started classifying paintings from sculptures, the etchings from drawings, and so on. But on the other hand, I think now when we came in the world where the things are too kind of classified, I think the certain universe is gone, or that we are lacking some parts because the things are too well classified. And that I saw my role as kind of like taking these drawers out as a nasty kid and kind of mixing contents of all these drawers in order to find kind of layers of meaning which were kind of forgotten, because you can't kind of come with a sculptural attitude and observe the painting. But then again, why not? If the layer of the brush stroke is thick enough, then you can simply start observing a painting as a sculpture, because there is a sculptural aspect which is thickness or third dimension. So I think if we rest kind of specialized or focused on the very few things, then half of the things are kind of missing.
Could I ask a follow-up to the documentation
yes.
question?
Yes.
So your work has been recorded, analyzed, archived, in many ways incorporated into the forces you seem to be opposing. So how do you view this historicization of post-history?
It is one of the ways that exists. I'm not bothered by it. If it helps kind of in developing the perception about what I wanted to say without distorting it, I'm for it. I have no this kind of like a hypocritical purist view that artists should kind of starve or kind of wear bad clothes. Or I mean, I don't mind. I think if we are fighting for the general cause of humanity, that we see more things, and if we can contribute to the better perception of things. So far, I didn't suffer from it.
I have another documentation follow-up. I was just wondering how you consider, or do you consider, all of the meetings and discussions that go into producing this work part of the artwork? And if so, would you want to be able to document that in transcripts or photographs or any sort of thing of these meetings, you know, with architects or any sort of thing to make it hang? Would you want that within the gallery space?
Not really, because I have this saying, or actually one retrospective show of mine in the Museum of Modern Art in Vienna was called, entitled Fast as a Thought, Slow as Light. And I think the artworks are very axiomatic. You can't add anything, you can't take anything out of it. And documentation is something which is different. I don't know exactly to what kind of documentation are you referring, but...
I mean, we had a meeting with the university architects to be able to hang Michael outside, or the casual passerby mm-hmm. piece, and that's part of the process of making sure that this work is shown. Maybe a transcript of that meeting, or photographs of the meeting took place. Is that part of the...
No, work? I would. This documentation is very precious to me. I mean, it could be shown on the video, but I would not necessarily... not show it. I would maybe show it, but I would not necessarily consider it as an artwork.
Yeah. I think we're getting into the very ambiguous definition now, but in a way there is so many artworks that I would call them, you know, having heart in the right place doesn't make good art. And nowadays we see so many of the artists who really got into good cause, and they documented extensively, you know, with video interviews, whatever social group is in question. And all this documentation, it's really taking, I think you may be referring to that because it's so present nowadays in curatorial practice, in artistic practice, to see so much documentation taking place of art. And I think where I come to the metaphysics is that art is something you can't reduce to the rational and documentary. And so, I mean, artwork, by some vague definition, has to have... Have in itself, like, poetry and anarchy and metaphysics, and something you can't put into documentation in a way.
So the relationships, for instance, that may arise on the part of the public with the passerby, it's part of the work, but it's not part of the artwork.
Please say it again. I floated somewhere.
All of us in the class, we're all very attentive to your interest in how the work is perceived and engaged, and the various relationships that may or may not emerge on the part of the public in this area. We understand that that's not part of the artwork, but it is indeed part of the work.
Definitely. Definitely. I mean, one of my first essays that I published in the kind of maybe 72 was entitled "Just as a piano is not music, painting is not art. This is a tool to get you into." So, like walking between that street corner where you see the passerby photograph, and then getting into this kind of like documentation piece, and when you kind of understand what is about, that's for me the artwork. But these are just the instruments. And but then the big question is how these instruments are formulated. I mean, sometimes there is too much. There are maybe sometimes too much of a Baroque nature. I mean, it is a question of articulation. And going back to what Nena said about these documentary pieces, now you have like many artists who sincerely or less sincerely are kind of like into the art, engagé in terms of kind of filming the homeless or asking the people who are working in car factories who are doing the whole day kind of these gestures, kind of... my personal feeling is that, I mean, if these works are not kind of axiomatically shaped or kind of not metaphysical enough, is that with visual misery, you can't help the misery of the world. I mean, in other words, if you create something that is divine in itself, I mean, however... it might be the work which talks about difficult issues. I mean, we know that it's almost a pleonasm to consider that there are kind of engaged artists and non-engaged artists, because art is a cognitive process, and therefore you deal with all issues that are touching a kind of society or mankind. So... it's really a question how these things are articulated and what they really transcend or transmit.
I want to make sure everybody has a chance to ask at least one question. Who hasn't asked a question? Okay. Maybe Wendy and then Christine.
Hello, I'm Wendy. And I'd like to ask about your series Triptychus Post Historicus.
Okay.
Partly because of our iguana here.
Yes.
And I'd like to ask, so... from what I understand, that the animals you used is sort of an analogy to idleness or the unknown and the unpredictable, sort of as a critique towards institutions, etc., like the classifying of art, that sort of thing. I'd like to know why you chose to use the zoo as opposed to something viewed as even more unpredictable, such as a real wild animal, as opposed to the zoo where animals there are caged, they're used to having people see them.
Okay, that's a good question, and I think I have an easy answer. No, the thing is that, for instance, zoo is obviously the museum. Everything is classified because you have a department of the wildcats, department of the alligators, as you have a kind of Renaissance, mannerism, Baroque, Rococo. So in a way, you go from this kind of same structure is applied now not to paintings but to animals. And I'm not Darwinian myself because... I think In my garden, I have a palm tree which is 50 years old, and it's about that big. It's like a bonsai. And I call it, with a lot of sympathy, like idiot palm. And I think that this palm is a kind of a lot more sophisticated than I am. Because in order to live, I have to travel. And this palm is just under the sun and even choose not to grow up. And I wish I was able to do that. And so to be back to Darwin and the Darwinistic theory, I think that amoebas are much smarter than we are. Because if you like observe the kind of history of machines in 20th century, like we always find like if the first mixers were this big and used the heavy electro engine of that size, and if we could have now like almost pocket mixers to kind of make our shakes in the machine that size, we think we achieved a great thing. And let's say if amoeba is that big and if the man is that big, then I think somehow we are in reverse proportions to Darwinian theory. Because if amoeba can live in with one cell and be in a cosmic harmony, and if I have to wipe my shoes in order to get to some exhibition opening, it's no good. So amoeba goes kind of to all shows without polishing the shoes or washing the hair or buying new kind of Versace clothes or whatever. So for me, the zoo was just one of the fields where this activity is kind of more concentrated. I have this statement from long ago where I say if one looks from the moon, there is virtually no distance between Louvre and the zoo. So in a way, for somebody who is very far in cosmos, for him it's happening because any puma running in Africa is so close to the Titian, which is in Louvre. But I mean, in order to kind of emphasize this cosmic perception on the earth and what is possibly kind of right or wrong, I kind of choose to act in the zoo as a kind of metaphor for what goes on in much wider spectrum.
I'm Christine, and I wanted to go back and ask a question about how your work is displayed. Often when it's outside and it's in a cityscape, there are many reflective surfaces that surround the work and create like a mirror image of the picture. How do you think this affects the way people perceive what you're saying, or necessarily how the work is perceived by people as a whole?
You know, I just mentioned earlier that if there is one visitor to the exhibition or one passerby who's kind of perceives correctly what he is seeing on the facade, for me it's a great achievement. And that's why I have a kind of like a suspicion to the works which are kind of created now and next week or next month or latest the next year, everybody knows about them. And then to kind of add to this is that there are these lucky periods of the civilization where you have these great art movements happening, when you have a kind of a right structure to house the right ideas. And there are simply these voids, and we cannot always count on the same proportion of the people who would kind of perceive and accept or reject these ideas. It depends very much on this kind of much wider invisible social structure which establishes itself once or twice every century. If you want to kind of elaborate on your question, then I could probably say more.
Well, basically, I was curious because basically a duplicate of your image is created across the way from where it is hung over here. And to me, it's kind of changing the idea of one single passerby and kind of creating two. So I don't know.
It is a nice observation, but it's also kind of metaphoric that maybe even if somebody just having this oral transmission, like if somebody said, oh, I saw this big photograph, and then this represents not Robert De Niro, but a passerby or whatever, then maybe somebody would be just smart enough to be like a reflection of somebody's information who would not commit the same mistake in terms of absorbing this image with no kind of reaction. So in a way these reflections are very positive.
Did you have any questions or not? If you want to ask something, because I wanted to say that nobody brought up the issue of Triptychus Post-Historicus, meaning these installations with original master paintings that Braco made in the various museums around the world, and since it's quite an important aspect of the work.
You did actually mention in relation to yeah, but I didn't elaborate on this.
You know, the installations with everyday objects and fruit and, you know, original masterworks were somehow, you know, kind of breakthrough into a museum institution
and the museum practice in a way, yeah. Because I think some friends who are kind of curators in different museums, they kind of acknowledge that I broke this kind of linear narrative. Like now very often in different museums you would see the work from the 50s hanging to the work from the kind of 90s and the work from kind of beginning of the century, or kind of you would find sometimes some conceptual artworks next to the impressionist paintings. And I think this kind of attitude to which I had in creating Passersby led me into an attitude to ask the curators to unhang the painting and to mix them with everyday objects and fruits or vegetables. And primarily, I did it for two reasons. One of the reasons was that people started treating these paintings exclusively as something that was of extreme material value, like object which has no other meaning than being worth 50 million. And for the respect of these works, I thought that they would be read differently, and they are read differently if they would have a bicycle or a melon next to it, because suddenly one would start comparing is the yellow of the melon related to the yellow pigment in the painting? Is that shape corresponding to something that is presented by everyday life as, for instance, every triptych is having a same structure. There is something that represents spiritual in the triptych that is painting, and then everyday object is representing something that stands for the everyday life, and then eternal cycle of the nature, independent from all human conventions is and unpredictable, is represented by these fruits and vegetables. And I like to underline the fact that I think that these paintings are extremely valuable for the fact that they are extremely meaningful and multi-layered, and that simply this all stratas are removed because people come with this fixed idea that this is 50 or 100 millions and nothing else. And I think one of the crises of the art world today is that artworks are perceived as something only extremely valuable and probably less meaningful.
Thank you, Bratza.
Thank you for all the questions.